It has always seemed to me that when we begin to study the work of a human being, we become interested in the human being behind the work. Perhaps this should not be true. Perhaps we should accept things simply on their face value. But we are all tied and bound to the human state, and we like to orient our heroes in that state. We are actually perhaps helped more by the humanity in man than we are in the supposed divinity in man. The humanity brings us close together, and in the case of General Pike, it reveals to us the happy combination of a scholar and a truly delightful person. A person who had many friends simply because he was friendly, and who had an almost unending sense of humor, even though much of his life was burdened with most serious responsibilities. We have tried to have something to say about the general as a person, therefore, each evening, and we're going to select a few points this evening from early articles about him, which perhaps are not generally known and which may not be included in the popular available biographies. After he reached the area of Little Rock, Arkansas, which he came to sometime after 1832, and here became a small village schoolteacher, teaching in a log cabin schoolhouse, we find that a natural tendency which showed from his early boyhood continued to unfold, and that was his poetic abilities, which were largely recognized and which undoubtedly have contributed to the beauty of the work that he did. We find, for instance, that while he was teaching school, this biographer notes, again his pen was busy writing verses for the Little Rock Advocate, as well as political articles, under the pen name Casca, which attracted so much notice that Horace Greeley reprinted them in the New York Tribune. And so, shortly after, there was a statewide search in Arkansas to discover who this Casca was. And it finally centered upon this rather amiable, somewhat timid, round-shouldered schoolteacher. And from that time on, his literary fame increased, and he has left quite a rich legacy of good poetry, which will be of interest to one group of persons. Also, Albert Pike was involved in the Mexican War prior to the time of the Civil War, and we find the following notes. In the war with Mexico, Pike won fame for his valor at the field of Buena Vista and enshrined the story of this occasion in one of his poems. After the war, he took up the cause of the Indians, whose life and happiness fascinated him, and who he felt were being robbed of their rights. He carried their cause to the Supreme Court, to whose bar he was admitted in 1849, together with Abraham Lincoln and Hannibal Hamlin. His speech in the case of the Senator Ward to the Choctaws is famous, and Webster passed high eulogy upon it. Judged by any test, Pike was a great orator, uniting learning with practical acumen, grace with power, and that imperious magnetism which only a genius can command. Albert Pike was made a Master Mason in Western Star Lodge No. 1, Little Rock, Arkansas, July 1850. And from that time on, we see the forces at work which caused him gradually to turn practically all of his learning in the direction of Freemasonry. He had brought to it brilliant legal background, a good literary background, and outstanding achievements in poetry and essay. And he also brought to it a tremendous personal capacity for research and study. As a result of his initiation into the order, and his gradual increasing interest in it from a philosophical standpoint, we find his following summary of the situation which caused him to devote his entire life, practically from that time on, with the brief interlude of the Civil War, to the advancement of the Masonic research program. He says of Masonry, "It began to shape itself to my individual vision into something imposing and majestic, solemnly mysterious and grand. It seemed to me like the pyramids in their grandeur and loneliness, in whose yet undiscovered chambers may be hidden for the enlightenment of coming generations the sacred books of the Egyptians, so long lost to the world, like the Sphinx half buried in the sands. In its symbolism, which, and its spirit of brotherhood, are its essence, Freemasonry is more ancient than any of the world's living religions. So I came at last to see that its symbolism is its soul." From this foundation, we can perhaps begin to estimate why he devoted the greater part of his effective, mature life to the effort to restore this symbolism, and why, in order to do so, he had to follow an ancient course, and that is to seek in the most remote corners of the world and in the most difficult branches of learning for the keys to these symbols. And also, as he expresses it, he had to penetrate layer after layer of interpretation, the incrustations of ages, the pollutions of both time and era, in an effort to restore as far as possible the primitive meanings of these ancient figures. And so this evening we are going to devote most of our time to exploring along with him and in his way the essential symbols with which he became concerned. Pike would have been the first to point out that these symbols are not the private property of Masonry. These symbols derive themselves from practically every tradition of the world. Yet that there must be, beneath all symbolism, a substance, a meaning real and valid, would seem to be of interest and importance to us all. For in the search into the field of comparative religion, in which symbolism plays a most vital part, we come constantly upon images and figures difficult to comprehend, confusing, and at the same time, utterly fascinating. We also realize that in this pursuit of symbolic lore to its fountainhead, we must begin with some conviction, some concept. And General Pike begins with one very basic fact, namely that the symbol, which has endured from time immemorial, going back to the earliest thinking, to the most basic ideals of the human race, comes the nearest to anything that we have to a universal language. The moment we lock our thoughts in words, we restrict our meanings to those of kindred tongue. The moment we attempt to interpret in the terms of familiar things, we also impose a dogmatism upon meaning. And gradually, most symbols have been dogmatized. They have been given a meaning, or perhaps a group of meanings. And these are assumed to exhaust the research in the subject. The moment we place a dogma upon any natural growing concept, we blight it with an early frost. We create a pattern of acceptances, a mere lip acceptance of terms and words and patterns, presumably exhausted by those who have gone before us. Pike warned of this very definitely. He stated that there may be 1,000 interpretations already known for a certain symbol, but if we are content to accept any or all of them, we shall some way deprive ourselves of the greatest adventure of all, and that is the personal exploration of the idea, the search within ourselves for meaning. and that the language of symbolism invites us all to search for meaning. He next assumes, which I think most of us here would concur with his belief, that not only was symbolism a language, but it was a language about something. It was a language relating to a particular kind of material, a particular level of fact. And the reason that this fact has remained expressed only in symbolism for thousands of years is due to one circumstance, in itself also undeniable. That is, that men have never found a better way of perpetuating these facts than through symbols. Had at any time the full and true meaning of a symbol been so completely, absolutely, and entirely crystallized that it could be presented in an irrefutable literary or philosophical statement, the symbol itself would have vanished. It would have no longer been significant. Men do not search for that which is found, but for that which is not found. The individual, therefore, is entitled to assume that the language of symbolism relates to something about which there is no common knowledge, about which there is no other adequate instrument for the perpetuation of certain ideas. What type of material would be, therefore, most likely to be locked in an enigma, to be concealed behind some form, shadow, or semblance not identical with its own structure or nature? The answer would have to be that it is some kind of knowledge pertaining to things not to be literally seen, not to be factually examined, not available in their full and pure substance, but to be known only through the lengthened shadows of themselves, cast upon matter, cast upon mind, and gradually molded into a fantastic imagery. Such knowledge as this would therefore not be the knowledge that has descended to us in philosophy. It would not be the knowledge available to us in the rituals and formulas of accepted theology. It would not be the type of knowledge that could be expounded in mere mathematical formula or revealed to us completely under a scientific hypothesis. It has to be something in its own nature so elusive that it cannot be captured and can therefore only be known through this shadow cast by itself. The answer again in Pike's thinking is obvious. That which is not available to us in knowledge is simple. It is knowledge itself. In other words, we know about many things and the substance of very little. We have learned opinions on innumerable problems, conditions, circumstances, but this essential knowing, which might cause the individual with the full realization of the meaning of his words to say, "This I know," this level of knowing is exceedingly scarce. And where it exists, it relates mostly to secondary things. We know that the sun appears to rise. We know the length of days and of hours. We know certain laws of architecture. We know certain ways of analyzing the chemical constitutions of things. By mathematical formula, we can split an atom. But by mathematical formula, we do not know what an atom is. The true and essential knowledge, therefore, is not in its pure substance ever available to man in a natural state. If it comes to him, how does he receive it? He must receive it by revelation, by vision, by intuition, by insight. He must in some way gain it through an experience which he cannot share with others. He may attempt to share, but the moment a knowing passes from him to another, that which comes to him as knowing is accepted by that other as an acceptance, as an opinion, as an interpretation, or as a belief. Therefore, that which we communicate can be believed by others. But that which we communicate can only be known to ourselves. There is this mysterious interval between self and others. And while our own insight may convince us of the inevitable truth of a thing, we also come upon another dilemma. The insight of others give to them different interpretations of the same thing. Therefore, to say I know is not only an indication of penetration, but it is also a completely individual project. The individual can know for himself. He may know that which is necessary to himself. But this knowing, he cannot say, will be identical with the knowing of any other person. He may like to affirm the philosophical concept that if persons come to the same level of insight, they will attain to the same substance of knowing. But as each person is different, it has become exceedingly difficult to assume or to discover even the levels of insight upon which a number of persons may function. The only levels we have available to us are levels of interpretation, levels of believing, and levels of acceptances. Thus, according to General Pike, it would seem obvious that a symbolism which is extended around the world and it descended throughout time, to be valid, to be worthy of perpetuation, to hold as it has the admiration of the most learned and the most informed and enlightened of mortals, that this symbolism must deal with these things about which man cannot come to external, factual knowledge. These symbols must therefore relate not to effects, but to causes, not to consequences as we see them, but substances as they exist in the nature of being. He is strengthened in this concept by another point, namely, that the great wealth of symbolism has grown up around sacred matters. The greater body of symbolism has to do with the attributes of deity, with the substance of human consciousness, with the nature of the human soul, with the substance and material of the human mind, and also, in large measure, with the great circle or cycle of man's psychic experience, leading not only through the years of this life, but postulating the future state of the soul in time to come and beyond the grave. These things, then, relate to certainties which men desire to possess, but which they do not, at the present time, adequately possess. Thus it is no common knowledge which can be easily rescued and then turned into sermons or into texts, but an uncommon kind of knowledge. That knowledge which has to do with ultimates, with infinites, and with the great universal values which men have sought from the beginning and about which even now they have come to no common conclusion. If this then be the burden of symbolism, General Pike can justify his own statement that it is to be found in its purest and most wonderful form in the great mystery institutions of the ancient world. These institutions were dedicated to the greatest spiritual values that we know. And the greater this spiritual dedication, the more luxurious was the symbolism employed, the more fantastic the imagery, the more complicated the keys to its unlocking. And wherever we went, or wherever we go in the search of the ruins of ancient wisdom, we behold the sanctuary ornamented with devices, difficult to interpret, of unknown origin, and dealing with the most abstract convictions of man. Now, symbolism then breaks down into a series of patterns, and our beginnings of symbolism undoubtedly go back to the dawn of our experience. And for a moment, let us pause and consider some of the most aboriginal pictoglyphs that we have been able to discover in the search for our knowledge of primordial man. On rocks, upon the face of great boulders and ancient cliffs, rising in desert and wilderness, we find strange devices, mostly simple, geometrical, basic forms. These devices are sometimes referred to as picture writing. There are many examples of picture writing right here in the state of California. We find many rocks covered with strange forms and figures. Why were they put there? Who put them there? How shall we decipher them? They were put there by crude instruments, perhaps the chiseling of a stone with a harder stone, perhaps in some cases with the use of early tempered copper, or as the Egyptians, various files and chisels and other instruments of soft metal, their teeth set in jade or in emerald in order to give them a cutting edge. These ancient symbols were put for one reason primarily. They were to perpetuate something. It was that the man who put them there, or the tribe who fashioned this strange picture writing, wished to leave a record of something. Perhaps his basic impulse was completely egocentric, although undoubtedly he had no awareness of it, never having been under psychoanalysis. But in any event, perhaps what he was searching for was one of the most basic needs that man experiences. He was searching, rather pathetically, childishly, desperately, for immortality. He was searching for that mysterious quality of not being forgotten. He wanted to live. He wanted to live in one of two ways that he knew that man could live. He believed, probably, from example and sorry incident around him, that this physical part of his own nature was fragile and would not long endure. But there was another part of it, his dream, his hope, the great and wonderful deeds that he had done, his claim to be remembered, his claim to make a contribution to those who came after him, his claim that those who followed would remember the hunt and the forest, and the day when he had slain the great mammoth. These things he wanted to have lived because they were his hero self. And today, even in this 20th century, there are well-educated, scientifically trained human beings who have had exposure to 3,000 or 4,000 years of culture, who will say today that no man has any immortality except to be remembered through his works. This is not an uncommon attitude among those who feel that they are emancipated from all the superstitions of the past. But this primitive man wanted to be remembered. He therefore used devices. And where did he find his symbols? He found his symbols in the beginning of language, nature. He found his first speech in the sounds of nature. He found his first designs and artistry in the simple, crude representation of things around him, things to which he gave a new kind of meaning. And in most cases, this meaning was a motion from a concrete to an abstract point of view. For example, perhaps he regarded the great cave bear as a very strong and brave animal. Now, this brought with it a gradual development of an idea, an association mechanism. And in time, the glyph of the cave bear was no longer a representation of this animal, merely to perpetuate the animal. It became the symbol of the attributes that the primitive mind associated with the animal. Therefore, this bear became the emblem of strength, or of courage, or of endurance, or whatever attribute the human being found most acceptable in the study of the animal. Thus, by degrees, men developed totems in which they took the names of these creatures as symbols of their powers. We find this still among American Indian tribes and among many other primitive people. And in all through the Central American complex of civilizations, we find that the totem, or the symbol of the person, is placed above his head in the glyphs. And this is the key to his name and to the virtues which he represents, or to the dedication of his own life to the exemplification of certain qualities. Thus we see the bear becoming the symbol of bravery. We see the sun losing its actual astronomical meaning to become one of several things. First, light. Second, time. The sun became a symbol of time because it gradually came to be called the figure of day, or days. And primitive man began his counting of days by the number of risings and settings of the sun. For a longer period, he chose the moon. And therefore, he began to have a kind of simple calendar. Things that were 3 days back were three suns back. Things that were 3 months back were three moons back. And beyond a comparatively small number of suns and moons, his chronology became rather corrupt. In early times, he had no concept of longer periods. This came later. But the sun then became the symbol of light. It became the symbol of days. It became an emblem representing insight. It became a sign of blessedness or of good. It gradually unfolded into a sign of wisdom because it was opposed to the darkness of night, which was ignorance. It became associated with integration and orientation, as opposed to the chaos of night. And by degrees, then, each of these natural objects gained a more or less abstract meaning, a meaning which carried it into a world of invisible values. A brave animal can be seen, or a brave man, but bravery as a fact is not visible, except by some action by which it is personified, or some condition which exemplifies it. So the moment man began to think of qualities as apart from physical objects themselves, he had to go into symbolism. He also found various problems arising in the development of his word structures, for he discovered early in life that the most difficult concept to express in some visible form capable of being perpetuated is motion. It is very difficult to indicate motion on an immovable surface. He could not make a glyph that would fly off the surface and therefore be true to motion. He had to create the concept of motion without an object itself moving. One of his earliest experiences in this, as we see by studying the pictoglyphs, is the use of a series of footprints. These footprints indicate a journey. They may also indicate that their beginning and termination, the locations involved. Locations at that time being so crude and rude, we cannot rediscover them, even from the glyphs. But this long string of footprints was not entirely a happy thing. He could try to create the concept of motion through representing his animals and other creatures, as in the ancient caves of France, in motion. But a bison in motion is not really a very happy substitute for a necessary abstract verb. It is not very solutional. Yet he had to have motion. You know, Maya solved it by putting a wing on a noun and making a verb out of it. The moment he added a wing, it symbolized motion. Very ingenious and requiring a great deal of thought to develop. But he did find the need constantly for creating forms for the expression of values not visible as objects. So out of this early struggle
came the rise of pictoglyphic and hieroglyphic forms. The hieroglyph was an organized pictoglyph, and probably the greatest development in this situation is found in the languages of Egypt and of China. In both cases, we have an inconceivable array of such picture forms. We may also, of course, mention the Maya glyphs, which number over 10,000. But unfortunately, they are not as easy to use as some of the others because we simply have not yet been able to decode them. But in the Chinese and in the Egyptian, we are in somewhat better condition. The Egyptian language, although it comes to us in its earliest form in a highly developed state, still shows that it was the inevitable evolution of the rough and crude cuttings upon the walls of cliffs and rocks. It is a gradual refinement. But the Egyptians began to discover means of making their symbols more valuable, making them more useful. They gradually came to identify, out of all of their animal pictures and their various symbolic devices, for each of which they had a name, they gradually developed a sound equivalent. This was frequently derived simply from the beginning of the name of the object. And an object like, for instance, arm, representing the human arm, suggested to them the possibility of the ah sound as well as the complete name. This ah sound could be combined with other sounds. Among the Aztecs, it was done more simply. They took two creatures, for instance, they wanted to make a word out of two names. So they would take the name for tiger and the name for snake. They wanted to use the first half of the name for tiger and combine it with the last half of the name of snake. So they made a glyph, the front end a tiger and the back end a snake. And then they proceeded to read it. It gave them, therefore, the possibility of bestowing this glyph as a name upon something. And this is how we read the place names of the old Mexican cities and towns. They placed this glyph in association with a little device called a mound. And when the mound and the place name were put together, it meant a city. If they drove a spear or an atlatl through the mound, it means they had conquered the city. And one by one, these simple devices developed. So the Egyptian language passed into a new form, in which it consisted of both ideas and of sounds. This became rather complicated. But it also gave rise to the possibility of the Egyptian attaining a certain written form in which he was able to express sequences of abstract ideas and use for these sequences hieroglyphs which suggested sound arrangements and by their grouping compounding names of objects. When they wished a word or a section of glyph to represent primarily a sound or an order of sounds, as in the case of a proper name, they placed a cartouche around it. That is, they drew a line around the entire thing, saying this is one word, instead of a series of glyphs. So in most of their manuscripts, we find picture writing, hieroglyphical development and structure, and then every so often, an encircled group of characters signifying that these shall be read together to form a name, or to form a proper word of some nature. This went on until gradually the pictoglyphic form began to fade away, and the symbols were not essentially changed, but passed through a condition of human carelessness. This human carelessness caused, finally, these glyphs to be drawn so poorly that as glyphs they were comparatively undecipherable. The individual taking these pictures simply streamlined them. He created a kind of shorthand out of them, using perhaps only the principal stroke of a particular glyph, the one stroke which distinguished it from all other glyphs. And he found that by degrees he could speed up the process of writing and the hieroglyphical form about the beginning of the Christian era began to drift into the hieratic form, which consists of the loss of the symbol in a conventionalized letter. As this proceeded more rapidly, the advantage of the picture glyph as a means of identifying objects gradually ceased, and the entire process moved into an alphabetic form, with words spelled out to form new dimensions for the concepts to be perpetuated. This also followed definitely in connection with the Chinese method of writing. We find that the original glyphs were very often very close to the object represented. Their little pitched roof character, which is essentially a roof, originally meant a covering, consisting of two lines drawn this way, just like the sides of a roof. Well, that was a covering originally. It finally became very much more involved. The oldest Chinese glyph for horse, for example, has four small dashes under it to represent the horse's feet. It was pretty literal. And among other languages, it is true that the Chinese perhaps has changed less than most others. Now, the Chinese have a symbol for tree, a very simple glyph. Now, they were also concerned with what we might term the plural forms, and how were they going to handle that. If they were somewhere and they found another tree, and they wanted to have two trees clearly indicated, they followed the line of greatest expediency. They made two trees side by side, and that was exactly what it meant, two trees. But this didn't end the problem, because it could get worse. Another man decided that he wanted to say that he had just been in the forest. Now, this presented a more or less complicated situation. You couldn't keep on drawing trees all over the page. So the happy idea of the simple plural came into existence. Above two trees must be many trees. So they put a third figure of a tree, and the result was forest. Above two means forest. A very simple device. And in this way, they had no difficulty in ultimately indicating their meaning. They had many different symbols when they made the sign of a roof. They then placed a symbol of fire beneath the roof, and a fire under a roof is a home, a place where you live. Another simple problem is that they anciently used for conveyance a kind of a cart. And if you looked down on this cart from above, you saw the axle running through the two wheels. You saw the flat, straight edges of the two wheels, and in between, a large rectangular mass representing the body of the cart. This particular symbol was reduced to simply mean center, middle, because it represented middle part, a central axis moving through something. And this became associated with the original name of China, which was the Middle Kingdom. Thus they went on, by degrees, building up a most elaborate group of writings, multiplying their strokes, increasing their skill and knowledge, until finally they produced a language so flexible that almost any idea which man can express can be rather adequately presented. These things all rose from natural symbolic instinct. The effort to use simple things to express or explain difficult things. The effort to convey a total picture of a meaning, and at the same time lock it only in a very few strokes or letters. To do this also, of course, created a kind of association. The individual who knew approximately the meaning to be intended got the complete impact of it, perhaps even more completely than we do with words today. They got the feeling of what was intended. They got a simple and direct relationship. They were not so far removed into polysyllabic forms as we are. And they did not have to rush to the dictionary the way we do, because they had a very quick grasp of the symbolic idea. Now, these are primitive things, but they point the way along which General Pike was exploring. And it comes then to the next important conclusion which he reached, namely that nearly all symbols arise from nature. A symbol is a form, and it must be derived from a form. We cannot have a symbol, a picture of anything, unless that picture is derived from something within our world of experience. Therefore, the picture must be the result of man's own eyes. He may add to the eyes certain reasoning powers, but he must first use the eyes. He cannot conceive of a form which does not exist, nor can he make a picture involving a pattern which has no similitude in life or nature. Thus he was forced to derive his language from his world and from the world of circumstances. Pike, however, points out what several other authors have also noted, namely that the selection of these forms and the investigation in the effort to discover appropriate forms for ideas forced primitive man to a most dramatic conclusion, namely that all forms around him in nature are themselves symbols, that a tree is a symbol. A tree is not merely a symbol for man to use. Man is simply taking a more ancient, natural symbol and reusing it. The fact that the tree is itself visible to his eyes is enough to prove that this tree is a visible extension of something not visible. Therefore, man can see the tree as it grows, but he cannot see the principle of tree. He cannot immediately apperceive tree as reality. He cannot know the life behind the tree, except by watching the operations of this life as these operations cause the tree to grow, or to in some way modify the various visible values which it exhibits. Thus, nature is itself one vast symbol, one inconceivable relationship of forms, all bearing witness to that which is not form. A number of particulars bearing witness to invisible principles that lie behind all the concept of particular. Thus, the authority of symbolism lies not in man's need for an expressing medium. The authority lies in the divine way of working. The universe itself, moving into manifestation, moves by projecting its own powers through forms, and these forms are symbols of these powers, mathematically, geometrically crystallizing around waves or rays or rates of energy, so that everything that exists is in some way a witness, an evidence, a kind of emblem standing for a principle, itself invisible. That this principle may be spirit, may be soul, may be mind, may be God, makes the symbolism only the more significant. For here we are confronted with the visible testimony of facts unseen, a kind of covenant by which man stands forever in the presence of his own greatest source of instruction. Thus, as Pike points out, the universe is a great university of symbols, a tremendous school of emblems and devices, through the contemplation of which man comes finally to understand himself, his world, and his Creator. Thus, symbolism involves us almost immediately in a series of great abstract values. And the fact of symbol is the first great link that man has with a world of spiritual forces operating behind the visible appearances of life. So the fact of symbol becomes the validity of symbolism. It becomes the proof of the meaningfulness of the entire concept. Man creating symbols, therefore, derives them by bestowing upon forms and likenesses already existing and already having meaning, other meanings according to his own qualified understanding. Therefore, he takes emblems having an absolute meaning, and he gives them a new relative meaning in order that he may use them for the extension of his own awareness in some direction or under some condition. If, therefore, the Chinese makes a glyph for the home, consisting of the combination of howl, of roof, fire, and the woman symbol, he is therefore expressing a basic concept. These devices are not home, nor are we to assume that he is merely attempting to establish the concept of a house. He is working for something else. He is working for the moral and emotional overtone of home. He is looking for its spiritual value, its ethical implication. And thus he captures in these basic forms ideas which are in harmony with his own insight. Yet each of these forms may have another meaning, a meaning especially in themselves. And this is true where the selection particularly involves natural working or natural objects rather than the artificial productions of man, as in the case of house, which is something man himself has built and therefore has a meaning peculiar to man. But when he draws upon the earth and the sky and the flower and the rock, he is drawing upon things which he did not himself create and therefore which have meaning apart from him, even though he wishes to give them a meaning of his own. In this way, symbolism has gradually associated itself with an infinite diversity of interpretive factors. And these interpretations, extending on through time, have been refined and revised with the changing of human beliefs. The ancient meanings have been restored and lost again. And finally, new meanings have been imposed upon ancient substances which no longer seem relevant. Man, however, hit upon one other happy device in the development of symbolism. He knew that he was concerned to a measure with the restricting circumstance of literalism. There was always the deadly danger which man faced, namely that in the field of learning, if he drew a picture of a tree, the student would be satisfied to say this is a tree and feel that he had solved it all. If, therefore, he surrounded the man primarily with only natural symbols, the human being would be almost in the same condition he would be without any symbols, because there are enough natural symbols forever around him. He sees the alternations of day and night. He beholds growth. He beholds all the strange and wonderful workings of natural law. These are his heritage. Therefore, to merely reproduce them for his intellectual advancement would scarcely attain its end. He would only be using a crude substitute for a nobler original. But man discovered, perhaps through his sleep consciousness, through dreams and other things, that he could introduce an element of fantasy into the representation of these forms. He could create a class of forms called composita. He could make a thing unworldly by putting together natural emblems and symbols in an unnatural relationship. He found, for example, that as long as he drew pictures of men to represent his gods, the tendency of the people was to come to the conclusion that the gods were men. It read downward instead of upward. Instead of conveying the impression, really, that man is a god, the reverse became the common acceptance. But when, as in the case of the Egyptians, the human head was taken off and the radiant globe-clutching scarabasaka was placed on the shoulders of the human body so that it became a human body with a beetle's head, the inevitable result had to be that the mind could no longer search in its experience for a living example of this. They just couldn't do it. Or when they placed the symbol of the head of Apis, the bull, upon the shoulders of the god Osiris, this Horipus, or this deity, could not be found among men. It represented a departure. Here we have now a fantasy. We had an unworldliness bestowed by distortion or by the creation of an unnatural combination leading to the recognition that the symbol had to do with something not of the common experience of man, but dealing with something else, something that could not be so easily interpreted and would have to be examined and explored upon a mental level or upon some plane of insight superior to that of ordinary mortals. Another simple way of doing the same thing was to disproportion the sizes of things, a very common practice, for example, in East Indian art. Here a great sage, teacher, or one of the deities is represented as a colossal figure, and the human disciple or student as a very small figure kneeling at its feet. The great figure thus became a symbol of unworldliness, a giantism, which elevated it beyond the common experience of man. Such, perhaps, was the tremendous subtle influence of the Olympian Zeus, this monumental structure, this tremendous figure, or the great standing figure of Helios, the god of the sun, that stood at the gates of Rhodes and has been preserved for us under the name of the Colossus of Rhodes. But by great disproportion, by great enlargement, an unworldliness was also created. Begin the refinement of things so as to create an unworldliness might mean a creation of so sensitive, so truly and completely beautiful a thing that no equivalent could be found among men for it. Thus sublimity was used as a means of exaggeration. As Leonardo and Michelangelo realized and exhibited later, also the dynamic of the so-called heroic proportion, or by the voluntary and intentional distortion of the anatomy or structure of the human figure, this figure became symbolic of something not human, something either superhuman or subhuman, something beyond our immediate ken of comprehension. A great study was made, for example, of the familiar figure of Michelangelo's Moses. And it has been pointed out that if this figure should stand up, it would be the most disproportioned piece of art, perhaps, produced by a classical master. The parts of the body are not in proportion to each other. But the compound effect is one of great majesty, of great force, and of a measure of patriarchal unworldliness, an escape from the literal, an escape from the obvious, into the expression of overtone through one kind of artistic subterfuge or another. Thus the symbol, in its simple language, began to take on many different aspects. Particularly, early man was interested in disentangling it from literalism and trying to use these familiar objects in a manner which would not convey merely a trite and familiar meaning. The symbol also gave rise to many other devices. It gave rise to emblems. And emblems, as pointed out by Quarles in his work on emblems, were really originally moral pictures. An emblem was a moral representation, gradually becoming more and more stylized until it became a device, became a kind of reminder of quality rather than an actual picture of it. During the 17th century in Europe, there was a great number of emblem writers. These writers moralized upon practically every symbol, device, work of art, statue, jewel, fabrication of antiquity that we know. Every one of these had to be interpreted to have some bearing upon the moral need of man. The purpose was to produce the good man, or to remind the individual of moral virtues by simple pictures. These books, of course, were largely worn out by children, because young people received most of their early schooling from these old emblem books. Another type, of course, that also came into prominence was the gradual development of the word emblem. In other words, symbolism was not absolutely restricted to a representation of an object. It could be associated verbally with the description.